Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
All right, so we had this hurricane, Isasaya. I mean, who names these hurricanes anyway? That's a tough one.
I don't know. I know a bird guide from Belize named Isais. Not a very common name.
Yeah. So we had some interesting birds blow in with these winds.
Well, yeah, it's all about the track with these hurricanes, and, you know, enterprising birders will keep an eye on that, because if it's over tropical waters or Gulf Stream waters and then tracks inland at the right pace, then it has the potential to bring Caribbean birds to interesting places. You know, you would think that you would go to places like Race Point and Provincetown to look for these storm-blown birds. They're seabirds. These are birds that, you know, you would see maybe, you know, the most likely place you would see them in the U.S. would be near the Florida Keys or, you know, the Gulf Stream off the southeastern U.S., maybe off Cape Hatteras, but not Massachusetts. But the funny thing is, the way this storm tracked, it picked them up and it carried them inland. And so birders noticed this, and so they went to places like Berkshire County. And so big reservoirs in Berkshire County, and if you're not familiar with Massachusetts geography, that's the inlandmost, westernmost county, nowhere near the ocean. It's, you know, basically part of upstate New York. it had sooty terns, Caribbean birds, flying around over reservoirs in Berkshire County. And so that's what these hurricanes can do. So birders get very excited, and they, you know, watch the track, and they make plans. And other people went to Wachusett Reservoir, which had some as well, and they stayed for a few days, I believe. So a very rare bird, very rare opportunity to see it in Massachusetts. Birders were out there capitalizing. And Race Point did have, I mean, coastal places did have some as well. Somebody, a local birder, had one. Oh, no, I'm sorry. There was a brown booby. Was another one of these storm-blown birds was off of Woods Hole, and sooty terns were seen in, I believe, Buzzards Bay, but certainly at Race Point as well. It was a productive hurricane.
In that regard, yeah. So when they blow into the Berkshires like that, do they hang around? Hot, I mean, they find their way back to where they're supposed to be going. I mean, I would think they'd be a bit confused. Yeah, they're like, wait a second.
It's hard to say.
We don't know.
It's such a rare event, and it's not something that scientists are studying. Like, you know, people aren't rocketing out there and netting them and putting transmitters on them. So we really don't know the fate of these birds, but they need to get out of town. They can't make a living on Oneida Lake in Pittsfield, you know, in Berkshire County. when you're a bird that lives in the Caribbean and breathe on the dry, you know, off the dry tortugas off west, you've got to leave Massachusetts pretty soon.
Boy, you said, oh, these poor birds, they're really confused, saying, where am I?
I would imagine. It'd be pretty disorienting.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories this morning. We'll also talk about other animals if you want to talk about something else you've seen. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I was watching, speaking of other animals, somebody had seen, I think it was a box turtle, but it was at the edge of the water. I think it was in Wacoit. And you're thinking, wait a minute, they're not saltwater turtles. So... But I guess they might cool down. Is that the idea? They just, with this heat, it's just so hot, they're looking for a little water to cool off. What do you think's going on there?
Yeah. I mean, we study box turtles at the sanctuary. Our former director, emeritus director, Bob Prescott, studied them for many, many years, radio tracking them. And now we have a volunteer named Tim O'Brien who's taken that on. And he knows everything that these box turtles do on our sanctuary. And one thing they do is they'll take some time off during the summer. And there's one that we track that spends a significant amount of time, like weeks, just kind of like sitting on the bottom of this little freshwater swamp on the sanctuary. And so, yeah, they will seek out water to cool off. they become inactive during the hot parts of the summer, and certainly this has been, you know, a droughty heat wave that we've had for quite a while. So this would be a time when box turtles would be seeking water and not moving around very much. But as far as salt water, it's not a great place for a box turtle. I'm not sure where exactly this was, but there have been reports. It was a box turtle that was floating across Wellfleet Harbor one time. Not sure how it got there. Probably, you know, got too close to the edge and ended up in the harbor and was floating around. I mean, they can survive it, but I wouldn't think they would want to be. They're not really saltwater adapted, and they might lose some of their body water if they hang out too long in salt water. But I'm not sure where exactly this was.
Yeah, you know, speaking of the heat, my bird bath has been, you know, as you know, I don't feed the birds anymore because of the rats. But the bird bath, if you're hesitant to feed the birds because you're worried about rats, I'd say put a bird bath out there because it's like they line up to hop in that thing and play around.
Absolutely. It's the easiest way to attract birds year-round. In winter, the trick is to have a heated bird bath, and then you're the cool house in the neighborhood with the spa offering for the birds. But in summer, especially now, when there hasn't been a lot of rain, you know, there are mornings where, like you say, I've got things lined up. You know, there's just like four different species hanging around the bird bath. There, robins are going in there repeatedly, flickers hanging out and waiting, several other things as well. So everything needs water, and so it's a very easy thing that people can do. You don't need to buy a, you know, $150 stone bird bath. You could put a plastic trash can lid, you know, if you're enterprising, and find various ways to provide water for people, for birds, and for people. Because my wife was just bringing me my coffee. Thank you. I'm wandering around outside. We're on vacation.
Ah, a staycation, you mean, right?
we're actually in Plymouth right now.
Ah, well, that was me last week. I was on staycation last week. It's plenty of time to watch my birds, and I call them the gang. I have this gang of blue jays. There's about four of them. There might be a couple, but I see four in particular who, I mean, they don't wait in line like the other birds. They just push them out of the way to get into the bird bath. But they're kind of fun to watch.
The blue jays.
Yeah.
So we have this new, our exhibit areas at Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary are not open yet. The building is now open in a limited way to people, but I'm excited for people to eventually get to see this new stream we put in. I mean, talking about bird baths and blue jays reminded me of this. Blue jays are one of the things that has been coming in and using this little kind of constructed recirculating stream that we have added to the feeder area that you see out our, you know, main exhibit area windows where the bird feeders are. And so the stream looks very natural, and it flows, and it has been incredibly attractive to birds who come in, especially in this weather. And so, you know, orioles, blue jays, robins, bluebirds, you know, everybody has been in there. And I think it's going to be a great photographic opportunity for people, because photographing birds at a bird feeder is kind of a bummer. If you're a bird photographer, you don't want a bird feeder in the frame. But this kind of natural-looking stream that things like orioles are coming in and bathing in, I think is going to be really attractive. And I've been testing it a little bit, and the times that I go there to the sanctuary, I kind of watch this stream from inside. The birds are still a little bit skittish. They're going to have to get used to people, but I got some nice photos of a blue jay taking a bath in there. Yeah, so, I mean, they're fun to watch. And everybody seems to behave themselves because the stream is big enough, but a backyard bird bath only has so much room, so they have to assert themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I saw a catbird do something I hadn't seen before. That the catbird had been in the bird bath, and it kind of jumped down on the ground, and it opened up its wings like, let me just cool off a little bit. I hadn't seen them do that before.
It opened up its wings?
No, it jumped out of the bath down onto the ground and just opened up its wings like, you know, I don't know if it was trying to dry itself off or just get some cool breeze with the wet wings.
Right. Drying, some combination of drying off, sunbathing, keeping parasite loads down, or the theories on that. You'll see birds doing this. I've seen, blue jays doing it. Mourning doves are famous for doing it. They'll do it to the extent where people think something's wrong with them. This mourning dove has broken wings. They'll sit there with their wings kind of flopped out. But it's a sunbathing thing. Herons do it. Herons have this funny yoga pose that they do. Heron pose, I think it's called. But they sit there with their wings sort of partly open in front of them, and just kind of catch some rays. It's one of those things that nobody has really proven. It'd be hard to prove exactly why they do this, but there are various theories of, just catching some sun and warming up, to, using the UV radiation to keep parasite loads down.
Yeah. Now, and of course, hummingbirds, we're seeing the hummingbirds more often now. I guess this is, now that all the flowers and things are in bloom, I have one that comes every afternoon, sort of like five-ish, and you can almost set your clock by this little guy.
That's great. There's always a discussion somewhere in the Facebook groups where someone says, I'm not seeing, what are other people saying? I'm not seeing my hummingbirds, but it tends to be a very local phenomenon. I mean, I had, after last year being a year where I had very little hummingbird activity in my yard, or they weren't coming to the feeders anyway, this year seemed to be back to normal, but other people were saying, no, they're not seeing them. But so it's just a funny, they're just kind of messing with us, the hummingbirds, yeah. They have their own local routines, and yeah. So you've got an afternoon tea type of hummingbird, it sounds like.
Exactly. So Becky writes us a note. She said, some folks found a box turtle swimming in Quissett Harbor yesterday, a much too busy place for a box turtle to be safe. We relocated it to an upland spot just above where it was swimming. That's a good point. If you find something like that, you don't want to take it way inland, right? You want to put it pretty much right where it is, just out of harm's way, right?
I mean, it lives locally there. I mean, they live in these coastal woodlands, and they do very well in them. There are more box turtles on parts of the Cape than anywhere else in the state. They just seem to, they're a state-listed species. They're a state threatened species, and they seem to do very well out here. There's no reason to bring them far away from where you found them. Salt water is not a great place for them, so that was the right thing to do, but just put them in some adjacent upland, somewhere safe, away from roads. Roads are bad news for turtles, so you always want to keep them away from roads if you're doing a good Samaritan relocation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Becky did the right thing. I'll talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have a mystery.
Morning. Oh, a mystery. We love mysteries.
Ooh.
Well, it may not be a mystery, actually. Every morning I go out and I take care of my horse and I fill the water tub, and I'm constantly finding pebbles in it. They sink to the bottom. And could it be crows doing that?
It could.
Do they use,
that was
how do they digest their food? Is it something they do?
How do they do what? Digest their food?
Well, I don't know. I've heard some birds will ingest small pebbles and things like that.
Grit.
These are about the size of a marble, and there's always four or five of them in the bottom of the tub, so I end up dumping the tub and rinsing it out and putting fresh water in. But what is doing it? I've never seen anybody doing it.
Ooh, this is a job for one of those game cameras. Those things used to be the purview of hunters, but now they're very widespread, and you can get one for your backyard, and they're digital and easy to use and not that expensive. So that would be a fun way to get to the bottom of this mystery, to see if it's a raccoon doing it at night. I don't know why they would. But what was it? Was it an old fable? I'm trying to think. Was it a scientific experiment or an old fable where the crow fills the glass full of water so it can drink the water because it couldn't get at it? I think it's an old story. But anyway, crows is a good guess, but
I have lots
doing
of crows. I have all kinds of things, but I'm sure it's not my horse doing it.
Yeah.
Pebbles.
Are you sure? How well do you know your horse?
Very well. He's 27 years old.
Oh, wow.
I guess so.
And he's in good shape.
That's great.
But, it's really annoying because I feel like I'm wasting water. I mean, I always give them fresh water, but I have to dump the whole thing. It's a huge tub, you know. Uh-huh. And I do have him inoculated against West Nile because I do have a lot of crows here.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I don't know why they don't have these things for people, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, good question. Yeah, I don't
know. The vaccine. Yeah.
Sure. Janet, thanks. And let us know if you see who's doing that. If you solved the mystery, let us know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number for your comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Since we were touching on crows, this was interesting. We were at the beach the other day. We went over to Woodneck, which, you know, there's a marsh there. And I was watching. First, there was a little band of crows who went over to this family's beach site. They had taken a walk in the marsh. So the crows were picking apart things. And, of course, the gulls noticed this. And what an interesting little show to watch this battle between the crows and the gulls and who's going to get the food that they've pulled out of their you know, bag.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a battle of the heavyweights when it comes to opportunistic feeding right there.
Yeah. They're so smart. How they even knew to pull things out of the bag to look for food. I saw them do this at a couple of, you know, as people take walks, they go to the, you know, their blankets and they start pecking around. They go, oh, no food here. Or I saw one gull, he had a plastic bag that he flew away with. I have no idea what was in it, but he was trying so hard to get into that plastic bag. And I'm sure he eventually did.
Oh, yeah. All these human commensals, you might call them, these animals that do very well by us. You know, whether it's raccoons and skunks and coyotes, foxes, crows, gulls, those are kind of the big heavy hitters in that group. And yeah, they know. They know to associate anything people have been doing outside with potential food, and it's always worth a try for them to sort through a bag. Or I mean, especially at something like a beach where people are doing the same thing over and over, where the bags always have food. You know,
right.
People always have food at a beach. And so they don't have to be incredibly high intelligence to figure out that bags mean food, and so they just got to go for it. Older and bolder.
Yeah, it was fun to watch this, you know, as the crow had something in its mouth and the gull's trying to get it, just the flying around, you know, the crow obviously seemed to be a much more graceful flyer than the gull and had, you know, no trouble kind of weaving in and out and around to get away from the gull, but it was kind of a fun little show.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't seen that before, the gulls would probably be more brute force, and I think crows would be more cerebral and tricky about it, I would guess.
Exactly.
That would be fun to watch.
Yeah, let's talk to Jay, who's giving us a call from Rochester. Hi Jay.
Hi, I have two sort of related questions. One is that they are spraying for mosquitoes in our area. And last year when they were spraying, supposedly they're using something called Anvil 10 plus 10. And last year our bird feeders went from really active to nothing for a few weeks. And I'm like last night they were supposed to be spraying, so we brought in our, you know, feeders and everything. But today everything seems fine, but I don't know if they actually sprayed. So that's one question. The other question is, I have a friend who lives in Wareham next to a cranberry bog. They were spraying the cranberry bog. She had her room air conditioner on and came home to find her macaw and cockatoo dead on the floor and another bird in severe respiratory distress that did finally make it, but the two that were closest to the air conditioner both died. I don't know enough about the stuff that is being used, but if the birds are dying, you know, next to air conditioners, you know, what's it doing to all the wild birds is one question, and then the Anvil 10 plus 10, how safe is that for, again, birds?
I don't know. Mark, do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, boy, these are some hot-button topics. As far as starting with the parrots, I would love to see, I'm sure this person doesn't have the means or doesn't know where to go, but I would love to see like a toxicology report or, you know, some sort of, you know, necropsy on those birds to see what actually killed them. I mean, historically, there's definitely some nasty stuff that goes, you know, just agriculture in general, like the pick on cranberries. I mean, just commercial agriculture uses some nasty things. Fungicides are very, very nasty compounds. I'm actually a licensed pesticide applicator is the funny thing, through work, but we don't really use very much, but there's some really nasty things out there, and I don't know, I can't really say anything. You would have to, you'd have to have some real evidence and you know what they were spraying and were they within the regulation
they were using, and that wasn't information wasn't being very forthcoming.
Of course, it's a tough situation. I personally wouldn't love to live next to a, any kind of commercial agriculture using pesticides. But in terms of the mosquito spraying, I wouldn't be. My concern wouldn't be for birds in terms of acute toxicity right off the bat. My concern with mosquito spraying is the insects that they eat. I don't think birds would be like dropping dead from mosquito spraying overnight. I think. It's the other insects I'm worried about. Where you know it's some of what they're a lot of what they're spraying is just a general pesticide. It's not specific to
mosquitoes. I think it also depends on when they're spraying, which is why they spray at night to try not to get the pollinators. But you know, Jay, I would suggest maybe calling you know the folks who are doing mosquito spraying and ask them some of those questions. I'm sure you're not the only one who's been curious about that and asking them. So I would give them a call and maybe they can tell you exactly what they're using and you can check that out. But
well, they say interesting question. That's what's on the internet, and it's a permethrin plus something else. And again, if it wasn't for last year, where I mean, it was just 100 to zero immediately. Because if you think if they're eating bugs, you'd think I don't know they would take a few days to sort of die off as opposed to
I'd have a hard time making a direct connection between mosquito spraying and birds you're seeing at your bird feeder. I don't know how to make that connection, but I do have a lot of concerns about mosquito spraying. Mass Audubon has been, you know, we have a position statement on it. It's worth checking our website for that. But the concern is that these are general insecticides when you're spraying for adults. And, yeah, spraying at night will reduce the number of non-target, you know, insects that are being killed, I guess. But lots of insects are active at night or they're exposed to the spray at night, even if they're not flying around. They're on the leaves and everything. So, I mean, there's a lot of
questions. Jay, sorry we don't have more information for you, but thank you for the call. Joanne is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. One more word about water, because I think that's the most important thing the birds can be looking for these days.
Yes.
I use a plastic dish that is the terracotta pots and the dishes that go under them are very available, I think. And getting a large one, like a 12-inch diameter plastic bird, plastic plant dish, I put it right outside on my deck, and the birds love it there, and they just, and I get to see them up very close because it's just a couple of feet from my window, and I find that a terrific, inexpensive way of having a bird bath for the birds. I have to fill that two or three times a day because everybody comes and does their washing up there, so I think that's a nice, inexpensive way of not having to have a pedestal bird bath.
Yeah, Joanne, that's a great suggestion. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. There are a million things you can use. Anything that holds water. You could dig a hole in your yard and line it with a trash bag and put some dirt over it. You know, they're using puddles, obviously, so you don't have to get too fancy with it. Just something that will hold water, and they'll be happy with it.
Yeah, yes. Joanne, thanks for that suggestion. Appreciate your call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Eva is calling from Mashpee. Hi, Eva.
Hi, good morning. I heard you say that you've stopped feeding the birds because of a rat problem. Now,
correct.
My year-round home is in Somerville, and I had to take down, I had three bird feeders in our side yard. I live in a condominium building, mm-hmm. and I was told I had to take them down because we had rat problems there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sad about that because the birds certainly welcomed the feed, especially in the hard winters that we used to have. Mm-hmm. So where are you? And here in Mashpee, we have our summer cottage by the Little River near Wacoid yep. Bay, and I haven't seen any rats here.
You know, they're tough to see. I tell you, I saw one, and, you know, we had all these holes that were dug in both sides of our yards, and, you know, guy came out and said, yep, you've got rats. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back was when one crawled up into our mini split air conditioner and died in the wall.
Oh,
and
oh
we
gosh.
Couldn't use that room for like 3 months. I'm like, okay, but you know what I've done instead? I mean, Eva, I'm with you. I miss the bird feeders too, especially in the winter. But what we've done, we have gardens, and what I do is I try to, you know, have as much plants that will attract the birds. I still have the same birds. They're just not coming to one spot. They're all through the yard. And,
that's
you know,
right.
of course,
the
bird bath. Yeah. But yeah, so, it's not a problem just here in my neighborhood. This is a problem all over the place. The
okay.
rats. I mean,
okay.
yeah. Yeah.
Well, I do see holes in our yard, and I thought, mm. and I hadn't seen them before, and I thought they might be just the voles or chipmunks, but chipmunks don't make holes like that.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know how to tell.
Chipmunks make holes that are
tiny,
silver dollar sized, not tiny, but if there's like a bigger network of holes, and other people are talking about rats and seeing them, then yeah, that's a good
and
guess.
You,
and yeah, you need to take
also,
down the bird feeders at least for a while.
Yeah, and they do like I notice that sometimes in the yard I'll find they're not holes dug really deep. It's almost like they made a little nesting spot at night to sleep in or something,
uh-huh.
you know. And
well, they're not sleeping at night.
Yeah. Well, whenever
they're
whenever
not
they
sleeping at night. That's
maybe they're
true.
Digging around
right.
for food there. I don't know, but yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So I should take, maybe I will take them down. I really, that's why I called. I went, what?
Yeah.
Rats?
Yeah.
Rat? I mean,
no,
I know that there are rats everywhere, but I don't
yeah.
think, I never thought of rats as being a problem.
Yeah, at
here.
Night, that's, yeah, they're out at night. And we were told, if you have any kind of food source in your yard, you're going to attract rats, unfortunately.
Right. And
yeah.
as a matter
yeah.
of fact, because of the bigger, population growth everywhere around me, there are people who have trash cans everywhere now,
mm-hmm.
much more than ever. So
yeah.
that probably,
yeah.
I hadn't even thought of that, obviously,
yeah.
Yeah,
around because there's more people and more food source.
Right.
Bird feeders have become kind of the primary scapegoat, but it's a lot of things. It's,
yeah.
You know, people are composting more, and I have occasionally had rats. I don't tend to feed them. Put out bird seed in the summer anyway. My yard's neighborhood's full of birds without them, and the bird bath, like we've talked about, does the trick. But there've been other times where I have seen a rat, and my Chihuahua helps let us know that it's around. Like you let him out at night, and he's like chasing something under the desk.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I've taken down the bird feeders, and they tend to go away. But one way that I know they're around is I see tunneling in my compost bin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, compost, backyard chickens, and, you know, year-round residents on the Cape who've been reading all the various newspaper articles about it because it's become a big issue. They know all this stuff. So
yeah.
it's this combination of things. But really, I mean, just think of cities and, you know, with the highest densities of rats, and it's trash. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's the
yeah.
biggest thing. More people, more trash, more rats. But then all you hear about for some reason is bird feeders.
Right, but it's any food source.
Yeah.
Basically, you want to
yeah,
try to reduce the food for them and to keep them from your yard. Eva, thanks for the call and good luck.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Heather, who's giving us a call from Harwichport. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Mindy. I'm Heather Bloom here. I'm calling about some fledglings of Phoebe flycatchers that I have nested under our deck. They've been repeat guests and we're always going after, you know, a couple of fledged broods. How long does it take for a Phoebe flycatcher to mature and mate again? And I looked it up. I don't see anything on the Cornell site about their actual maturing age.
Yeah. Well, songbirds, it's a year. So they'll be able to breed next summer. So this is their juvenile year. You know, I mean, you're talking about a bird that's weeks old. Just the adults that will be breeding in any given summer. And then next year when they come back from migration, a one-year-old bird will be ready to breed. In some species, the one-year-olds are not as successful. Longer-lived species, raptors, you know, bigger birds, sometimes they're not breeding until they're 5 years old. But with songbirds, they don't live that long, and so they can't waste too much time, and so they're generally breeding in their first summer back. And we had some Phoebes in the neighborhood. They didn't nest in my yard. They nested under my neighbor's, the eaves of the shed, and they were parasitized by cowbirds, unfortunately, the first brood. But it seems like they might have gotten a second brood, because I had a juvenile. I mean, it could have come from anywhere. They wander around once they've fledged. But I did have a juvenile, and you can tell the juveniles, they basically look like the adults at this point, once they've been out of the nest for a while. But they have two sort of tawny wing bars. It's sort of subtle. And I have a picture of my six-month-old daughter, Phoebe, looking out our kitchen window at her first Phoebe, this other young Phoebe that was sitting on my son's plastic slide outside our kitchen windows. That wasn't really.
They're amazing parents.
Share it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Heather, you said
that's what I noticed, is amazing parents.
Yes. I mean, birds in general. I mean, the drive to feed their babies is so strong, and they're just working. And sometimes they're feeding other species babies. And there's been some talk about that. Something I've seen in the past where, that's how cowbirds make a living, is they tap into this very strong desire to raise chicks, even if they're not the right species. And so female cowbirds lay their eggs in other birds' nests, and very, very commonly those chicks are raised by the host parents. And that's what happened in my neighborhood with a couple of different species. I saw a towhee, one of the local towhees, eastern towhee in my neighborhood, was feeding a cowbird chick just within the last couple of weeks, and that first brood of Phoebes. But I was glad to see a young one. So some local Phoebe nest was successful maybe the second time around.
Yeah. Heather, thanks for calling and sharing your story
with us.
Okay,
one last question. When do they leave?
Phoebes are tough. So most flycatchers head south. Most flycatchers winter in Central and South America. But Phoebes are tough, short-distance migrant flycatchers that can winter in temperate areas. And so the occasional Phoebe will actually spend the winter on the Cape, toughing it out somehow, you know, supplementing insects with fruit. Phoebes will leave in like September, October. They're not an early migrant. Some songbirds are already on the move. Like I'm hearing, you know, in August you start hearing the little, even late July, you start hearing the flight calls of things like yellow warblers that are kind of starting to move around and migrate. Orchard orioles are migrating to Central America already. But Phoebes are tough, and they'll be around into September and October. And like I said, some might even linger into the winter and through the winter, especially on the Cape where we have milder winters.
Yeah. Heather, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing. Let's talk to Henry, who's calling from Eastham. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, Mindy. Mark.
Morning.
Our side yard is a wooded quarter acre with pine trees and oaks. And I walked out there, you know, to clean up some of the litter. And I see around the tree bases, earth is all, the litter is all scratched away and down into the sand itself, about 2 feet in diameter hole. And I was wondering what that was. And then that's a couple of weeks ago. And then now we've noticed that there are hen turkeys out there. They just go out and sit in those places. And I've never seen that before. And yesterday, there were half a dozen or so of them out there. And all of a sudden, our daughter was closer on the porch, and I was next door, and I heard this cacophony of sound, and then a whole herd of this of these female turkeys were, they seemed to be chasing somebody in that herd, and they ran by across the yard next door and ran away. But the sound was tremendous. I've never heard a group of turkeys make that kind of sound. I was just wondering what was going on, if they're trying to get cool in the sand. And
I never know what's going on with turkeys. I watch them all day long at a bird sanctuary, and I still don't know what they're doing. What's going on in that little head? The one thing I can't figure out is the flocks. Like, you'll see four one day and 12 the next in the same spot. Like, who are you? Like, what you know, who are these birds? But in terms of the dust, the little dust baths they make, or just a depression to hang out in, yes, they can be very destructive to the ground if it's, you know, if you don't want them to be. You know, if it's a landscaped area, they do a lot of digging around, and they'll make a big dust bath to flop around in, or just a depression to sit in. And like you said, it might be to stay cool, depending on the weather. But yeah, they do a lot of scritching and scratching. And in terms of what was going on with the chasing, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, as the summer goes on, flocks start to form up, and they have a really long breeding period. And so there's still like brand new, just hatched babies out there right now, as well as babies that hatched 3 months ago that are fully grown. And so the flocks will get bigger through fall and, you know, late summer into the fall. But I don't really know what determines their kind of social structure or what exactly they're doing now.
Yeah.
They're arguing amongst themselves.
we have them all the time, you know. They like to come through that side yard, and they usually spread out and they make an occasional squawking sound. But yesterday was extraordinary, so I just thought maybe you knew, so...
Yeah, they're mad about something, maybe. Henry, thank you for the phone call. Yeah. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Marilyn in Chatham writes, unfortunately, the cowbirds were very successful in our yard. Two were being fed by cardinals back in June, one last month with a chipping sparrow, and this morning there was one with a song sparrow. Those were the only ones I saw. It's so depressing. It is kind of depressing when you think about what happens when those cowbirds are harassed.
Right. I guess it depends on your perspective. It's not depressing for the cowbirds. They're like,
No, I was going to say.
And those are all common.
They're the only ones who are happy.
So the thing with cowbirds is, around here, the species that I see them hitting are species that are very, very common. So I don't see any evidence that they're having an impact. I mean, song sparrows, like every backyard has a song sparrow. So somehow they're able to kind of shoulder that burden, you know, go without fledging their own chicks for a year or at least a nesting attempt, and it doesn't seem to affect their population. But there are situations around the country where you have critically endangered songbirds that are in part endangered because of cowbirds. And cowbirds are just doing what cowbirds do. It's humans have changed the landscape in a way that tips the scales in favor of the cowbirds. They used to be out in these kind of open plains, and they would parasitize birds in like little, you know, riparian woodlands or like little woodland patches. But we took the unbroken eastern forests, or relatively unbroken, and we carved them up into little fragments. And so that has favored cowbirds. That didn't used to be an issue for birds around here. So I'm always amazed that these local birds, like yellow warblers, get hit really hard by cowbird brood parasitism, song sparrows, like I said. But these are very, very common birds. It doesn't seem to have an effect. Mm-hmm. But other species, black-capped vireos and golden cheek warblers, are two endangered birds. In Texas, they get hit really hard, leach-billed vireos. Kirtland's warblers, so there are some endangered songbirds where they actually have to control cowbirds. They have to use lethal control on cowbirds in order to keep them from going extinct. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic between cowbirds and their songbird hosts.
Yeah. So you touched on the fact that some of the songbirds are starting to migrate, but give us a little migration update. Shorebirds are migrating, right?
Yeah, who's going where and why? Shorebirds have been migrating since early July. First, the adults, they'll get their chicks to a certain point, hatched and fed and grown to a certain point, and then they'll start heading south and abandoning their chicks up on the Arctic tundra. And so the adult shorebird migration has been going on for a long time, and we're getting towards the time when we start to see the young ones looking all crisp and clean with fresh pale-edged feathers, a nice kind of scallop look. Juvenile shorebirds are better looking than the adults this time of year because they're new and fresh. But like I was talking about earlier, songbirds are also migrating, even though it seems like it's still midsummer and still breeding season, you would think. But some things are done. There are some warblers, like yellow warblers, are moving around now, and they're a fairly early migrant, so they're migrating out in August into early September. Even the least terns are still breeding right now, still, sitting on eggs. Least terns sitting on eggs now, those eggs will never turn into successful chicks. They keep breeding until they just abruptly stop and leave. So they leave earlier than the other terns, and they'll be heading south very soon. There's all kinds of migration going on now. Things are coming, things are going. Seabirds came into the area a month or so ago, and they'll be heading back out at the end of the summer. So there's always something going on.
Yeah.
even though it's like dead heat, the heat of summer, and you're not really thinking that birds are migrating, they definitely are.
Yeah. So one thing I want to mention, we're talk about the role of pollinators. We take pollinators for granted, and I know the sanctuary's got a class or something. What's coming up? There's something that we can learn a little bit more about pollinators and their importance.
Yeah, so this has become an obsession of mine in recent years, and I'm sort of a wannabe entomologist. I secretly just study insects. He's the bird guy, but when you're not looking, I'm trying to get better at insects. and so we are leading a field school, and it's got to be kind of a different than our usual field schools where we are sitting in an auditorium, looking at presentations. It's going to be part virtual and part field trip, and it's the weekend of September 5th and 6th, and so I think that we might have some Friday evening lecture, and then a mix of lectures and field trips that we'll do Saturday and Sunday to look for. There's going to be a focus on bees. I'm leading this, and so I need to make sure I'm studied up. And so we'll be looking at things, native bees, right? It's not honeybees. There's thousands of species of native bees that are incredibly cool, have amazing life histories. There's some right under your noses in your own backyard that we want to teach you about and, get you looking at and thinking about. And bumblebees in particular, we'll be looking for some of the lesser-known bumblebees that are around besides the eastern bumblebees that are the ones all over your catmints and whatever. Mm-hmm. There are some other less common ones out there that we might go looking for, but just all about native pollinators. And, we'll touch on things like butterflies, all of the general pollinators and things that people like to look at, but maybe go a little deeper with bees. I'm really looking forward to that. It's a really important issue, and I like getting people into that. We'll talk about gardening, things you can do in your landscape to help them. There'll be a lot of interesting takeaways for people interested in pollinators. So,
And we'll put a link to more information about how you can sign up for that at our website, capeandislands.org. And aside from your interest in insects and pollinators, you've been really doing a lot of research on plants. I know you've redone the little garden outside of the sanctuary there. And so just kind of a couple of thoughts. Some of the more native plants that would be attractive to pollinators are also attractive to birds, right?
Yes. Certainly anything in the daisy family, in particular. I mean, take a garden, like a cottage garden standard, like coneflower, purple Echinacea purpurea. It's actually not native to New England, but it's considered a native. It's a, like a Midwestern plant that is just everywhere. People have it in their gardens. And it's excellent for small native bees. Butterflies really like it. And then if you don't deadhead it, if you commit to being a messier, wildlife-friendly gardener, and you don't do your cleanup until, you know, spring, if at all, then those seeds will be attractive to goldfinches in particular, but sparrows and other things as well, seed-eating birds. And certainly there are some trees and shrubs. Trees and shrubs is the place to start for really making the most impact for wildlife in your landscaping decisions. So, you know, keeping the oaks and then adding things like winterberry, which is a beautiful, very common landscaping shrub available at every nursery that will attract things like bluebirds and certainly flocks of robins in the winter to eat those fruits. Chokeberries. There are lots of good choices feed the bees in the spring or the summer, and then can feed the birds
in the winter. Yeah. Let's talk to Lynn, giving us a call from Yarmouthport. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning. My question, since we're talking about pollinators, I have just gotten some pyrethrin because my terracotta pots have either aphids or white flies. And when I read what is all the warnings on this, now I'm worried about my pollinators. Is this something I can put on these flies and still not kill my pollinators?
Maybe you can pick that up with Roberta next week.
Yeah.
I guess my first question is, like, is the insect population at a level, so this is like I'm going into integrated pest management here, is the infestation level harmful? Like, do you need to do something? That's the first question you need to ask. I mean, I think sometimes, I'm not saying you're doing this, but sometimes people are like, I saw this bug on my plants. Let's buy some, you know, seven.
Right.
You know, it's like, whoa, why? Do you have any idea if it's actually harming the plants? And so that's the first question. Is it aphids or something that are not necessarily going to kill a plant? I'm not an expert in this, and you need to look into it yourself. But I have aphid infestation on different things that I don't do anything about, and then the next year it's fine. I'm thinking a vine in particular that I have that gets aphids every couple of years, and it's really not a big deal.
Yeah, Lynn, you know what? Roberta's here next Tuesday, and we can ask her that question if you call in or shoot us an email. I think it probably depends on when you apply it, but let's check in with Roberta next week, who is also an entomologist besides a horticulturist, and she'll be able to answer that question for us. So, Lynn, stay tuned for that. Thanks for being with us.
Okay, and,
there's some things.
Yeah, real quick, Mark.
You know, don't spray it on flowers. You know, don't... Mm-hmm. Keep it away from where bees would be interacting with it. The first question is really, do you even need to do anything? And the answer may be no.
At that point,
there you go.
All right. Mark Faraday is science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. And Mark, thanks as always. See you next month.
See you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.